On this episode of Killer Jeans, could a missing teen in Michigan and a dead Navy wife in Virginia be related crimes?
I live this day right now to regret it. And, you know, it shouldn't be like that. What? You know, what I found out was that that decision got her murdered.
Has a serial killer been living among us for the past 40 years?
We knew there was a person out there that was the killer. We knew we had a DNA sample. We just had no idea which bale of hay we should be looking for that needle in.
A detailed look at how DNA advances and a brief random encounter led to the capture of a man who has rained violence and terror across the country for decades. The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised.
Emmy-nominated true crime journalists bring you cases like you've never heard them before. Hear firsthand accounts from the victims' families, private investigators, lawyers, law enforcement, and even the convicted. Giving you a complete 360 of the case like no one else can.
I'm Melissa McCarty.
I'm Kelly McClear.
And this is Killer Jeans.
The first part of this story starts in Allegan County, Michigan. An interesting piece of history for you. It's an agricultural area now urbanizing with tourism as it borders Lake Michigan. The county's name was coined to recognize its first settlers, Native Americans, the Ojibwa tribe, actually, also commonly referred to as the Chippewa Indians. Now, funny enough, I am a member of the Chippewa Indians on my mom's side, and my family was born and grew up in Michigan. In the 1830s, the Chippewa Indians were forced to hand over land, striking a territory deal with the federal government. Now, this is the origin of the first murder mystery.
And this area is now back in the spotlight, now known for breeding a confessed serial killer. The headlines began in 1989, when a 14-year-old girl in Allegan County disappears. Her parents tell police their daughter, Andrea Bowman, has run away a few times in the past, and they fear she's done it again and stealing money before she left home. Those involved say resources weren't allocated to look for the runaway teen.
She was bullied in high school, had girls, taken on her and beaten her up, and one girl stomped on her foot.
Were the school bullies enough for Andrea to vanish at 14 years old and never be seen or heard from again? To learn more, we had to go back to her childhood. Turns out, Andrea was adopted.
It was a grown-up decision made by a little kid, and I regret it.
Kathy Turkanian, the biological mother, is sharing her story with us.
I had gotten married very young, became pregnant at 16.
Kathy says her daughter was born in 1974, named Alexis. Kathy doesn't refer to her long-lost daughter by her adopted name of Andrea, only by her birth name of Alexis. She says at the time, her young marriage was fragile and quickly fell apart. Her hope was to find some resolve and life direction while staying with her mother in Virginia.
Well, when I got there, I found out she was sick with breast cancer and the prognosis was very poor. And so any kind of staying there and finding any stability there was not going to happen. And my mother was, she had young kids, so she's kind of desperate. And I think sort of, making plans for everybody because, I was still a kid. So she made plans for me and Alexis. And those plans were for me to either give my daughter to her or give her up for adoption. And there was no way I was going to give my daughter to my mother. Number one, she was possibly going to die of cancer. And secondly, there was no way I was going to let her raise her. She'd run me off at a very young age. And she pressured me. And I finally decided when I was 17 that maybe it was a better idea to let her go.
Here starts the problem. Kathy, a teenager, gave up her daughter to a Catholic charity to handle the adoption. Turns out, for some unknown reason, the agency gave her now 9-month-old to the state of Virginia's adoption agency in Norfolk.
I was basically told, I was conned into believing she'd get the best family out there if I let her go when she was little bitty.
She was adopted by a Navy man, Dennis Bowman, who was stationed out of Virginia, along with his wife, Brenda.
More than 10 years later, Kathy Turkanian received a letter in the mail.
It said, we have something really important to discuss with you. This was from the Norfolk agency that handled her adoption. Please get in touch with us. I really thought I was going to hear Alexis has shown up and she wants to meet you and here's her contact and good luck with all that. Instead, what she told me was a detective had come to her office looking for DNA so that he could rule out that a Jane Doe who was found in Racine, Wisconsin in 1999 wasn't my missing daughter.
The only piece of information is that her daughter could be missing, dead, or a possible case of mistaken identity.
So I had her birth date and I kind of, just sort of lost it. And my husband started searching for anyone missing that birth date, listed on missing persons websites at different states, different towns, different. And he found her and missing from Hamilton, Michigan in 1989. And that actually the Michigan State Police had a website and she was on it.
It ignited Kathy to turn amateur detective, looking for clues on her own, trying to make contact with people in her daughter's life at the time.
I think I just got online and started thinking what would I do if I were looking for someone? Where would I start? I would start the last place they were seen. And one of the last places she was seen was at school. And I opened up a classmate's account for her just to see if maybe somebody in high school, because I was able to locate what town she came from. I was able to, and it was just like one high school in the town. I figured I'd be able to find some people, and sure enough, that's what happened.
In a kismet circumstance, searching the same website was Carl Koppelman, a forensic artist and sleuth who created DNA Doe Project and was moderating a panel going through missing persons when he spotted 14-year-old Andrea Bowman's poster and did some digging of his own.
Went on to classmates.com and noticed that Andrea had a paid subscription to classmates.com. And I thought, that's odd. If she's missing, somebody other than her wouldn't pay for a subscription to classmates. And so I thought that was strange. And I said to this woman who was a friend of Andrea's, I said, will you send a message to, a private message on classmates to whoever has that account.
I just think it's fascinating that you guys were doing independent investigations and that led you to one another.
It's completely serendipitous.
Yeah, right. It is.
Yeah, it's serendipitous that you two are independently working to find Alexis or, her birth name. And it turns out you both are kind of stumbling upon all the same facts and information at the same time.
And you went to the same source, classmates.com. It's now 2013. Internet sleuth Carl and biological mom Kathy teamed up and over time became a force even the police would have to acknowledge. First, they used the Freedom of Information Act for all related documents on Andrea's adopted family, the Bowmans.
We saw who this guy was who had adopted Kathy's daughter. It was a complete shocked to see that this guy was a pretty violent criminal.
Dennis Bowman's rap sheet was extensive, as Carl and Kathy would find, going through various transcripts over his numerous cases. In 1980, Bowman was charged with an attempt to kidnap and assault a woman named Karen.
The way the victim described it, Dennis was riding his motorcycle along a highway that runs parallel to Lake Michigan up north of Holland. There's a highway, shoreline road, I think it's called. But he was on his motorcycle, and she was on a bicycle riding riding northbound on Shoreline Road. And Dennis drove by her on his motorcycle. Well, she said he turned around, came back the other direction, and then turned around again and pulled up alongside of her, ran her off the road, forced her off the road using his motorcycle, got in front of her, so she had to turn off the road and onto the shoulder of the highway. And then he pulled out a gun and said, get off your bike and go into the woods. And the woman was, this woman, she was 18 years old at the time. She just sat there on her bicycle, shocked, didn't comply. He kept getting more angry and angrier at her refusal to comply. He says, if you don't do what I'll say, I'll blow a hole right through you, as you know, his words. And she still refused to comply. He fired a couple of shots, one passing to the side of her and the other one at her foot, fired his gun twice. And she still wouldn't comply. And at that point, a pickup truck approached on the highway. He turned around to look at the pickup truck, and she saw that as the opportunity to take off on her bicycle, and she pedaled away from him on the bicycle out into the middle of the street, stopped the truck. The woman in the truck stopped, and she threw the bicycle into the back of the pickup truck and jumped into the truck, and it was taken away from the scene, so she got away from the attack.
A woman passing by called 911 describing Bowman and his motorcycle. He was spotted by sheriff's deputies, arrested, and charged.
As they were detaining him, he was protesting, oh, I need to be over at my daughter's kindergarten to pick up my daughter. So as he was committing this crime or preparing to commit this crime against this young woman on a bicycle, was right about the time that Andrea was finishing up her kindergarten class.
Andrea was 6 years old at the time. Bowman was out on bail pending his trial when he flew back to Norfolk, Virginia for his naval duties.
This is something that shook everyone's sense of security because it hit in the most, what was perceived as the safest, quietest, best area of the city for a young couple to live. And when you could not get resolution or answers, then people's sense of security never really was returning to normal.
A long overdue cold case was about to get extremely hot. Phil Evans, the deputy Commonwealth attorney in Norfolk, says the region has had its share of murders, but the one that would take place September 9th of 1980 would haunt detectives and the community for 40 years.
The victim was Kathleen Doyle, a 25-year-old college graduate and wife to a Navy pilot on the USS Eisenhower. On this fateful night, Kathleen invited a girlfriend over for drinks.
Vivian Mahoney, and Vivian Mahoney's husband was also in the military, but Vivian was a good friend of Kathleen's, and she came over, and the two of them just sat down in their living room, and they shared glasses of wine, and essentially just talked back and forth that evening. And Ms. Mahoney, I think, later told the police that she had left somewhere around 9:30-ish in the evening. And when she left, Kathleen was home by herself. Later that night, and this is back in 1980, before we have cell phones, they actually had a home phone, and Kathleen tried to make one call out of the house, long distance, and there was no connection there. And then we know later that night, around 11:30, her mother, Kathleen's mother, had tried to call her long distance, but Kathleen had not answered.
Nothing obviously alarming at this point, but the phone troubles would later become an important piece of evidence.
The next day, which was a Wednesday, September 10th, the Vivian Mahoney tried to get in touch with Kathleen because they had planned to go shopping or they were going to have some sort of activity during the day. And Kathleen never answered, nor did she get in touch with Vivian. And she thought that was strange because Kathleen was very dutiful. She was a very organized person, very vivacious, very outgoing, and had just a personality that attracted people as friends. So Vivian was a little bit concerned, but she sort of pushed the concern aside. Finally, on that Thursday, September 11th, she and her husband, James, were scheduled to drive out of the Norfolk, Virginia area. They were going on a short road trip. And Vivian essentially convinced her husband, hey, let's stop by and check on Kathleen because I'm a little bit concerned.
Kathleen Doyle's house sat next to a church, just feet from its parking lot, separated by some bushes. When her friend Vivian approached, she noticed newspapers piled up at the front door. She peeked through a glass opening on the front door and noticed there are two wine glasses in the same position. She gives the front door a little push. It wasn't securely shut and opened up to the home.
And there was a little hallway that went back to the bedrooms. She looked into the one bedroom. She let out a scream because there she saw her friend Kathleen on the floor of the bedroom. Vivian then ran out of the house screaming to get her husband's attention. When Vivian ran out, her husband James had parked the car along the edge of the main street. He got out and came into the Doyle's house, and he went in to the bedroom where Kathleen was laying on the ground. He could tell by her appearance that she was deceased and had been dead for some period of time. Her appearance, she had no clothes on. The police would document the fact that her hands were bound behind her, and what later became important to the police investigation in 1980 was that the cord or the twine that was used to bind her wrists behind her was not a common type of twine that was sold commercially throughout the area. It was something that had more of a naval use to it, and it was something that would be utilized in a number of applications on ships. Now, at the same point in time, obviously the police were aware of the fact that Kathleen's husband, Steve Doyle, was a member of the Navy.
Turns out, Kathleen's Navy pilot husband was deployed, stationed in the Indian Ocean during the time of his wife's murder. The more detectives searched the home, the more baffling. No forced entry. No broken door. No broken door lock or windows.
She was actually found off the bed on the floor between the door and the bed. And what Mr. Mahoney immediately noticed was first that the room was consistent with some sort of a struggle. The mattress was displaced. It was not in its position square on top of the box spring. It had been moved. And the comforter or bedding that appeared to have been on the bed was now underneath where Kathleen's body lies. In addition to her wrist being bound behind her, there was also evidence that Mr. Mahoney observed that she had been strangled as well, and that there was evidence that she had sustained some type of wound that had caused her to bleed. At that point in time, he backed his way out of the room and asked his wife, Vivian, to call 911, call the police. The two of them then took the logical next step, which is they went to the phone in the house.
Now, remember the phone trouble Kathleen was having minutes after her friend left? Was her home phone already tampered with? Was her killer already inside the house, lying in wait?
There in the Doyle household. Another strange point came up at that time. When they tried to make an outgoing call, they were unable to get a completed connection to the number they were dialing and tried repeatedly to call with no luck. And eventually they actually had to run next door to call the police to respond to the location. It was later determined that the mouthpiece in the phone had been removed from the phone handset. And again, this is 1980. It's an old school mouthpiece and earpiece phone with a cord. And essentially someone had gone into the phone and removed the mouthpiece.
Semen was found in Kathleen's cervix and vagina. She had signs of sexual trauma as well. But in the 80s, DNA analysis hadn't evolved yet, nor were records shared between law enforcement agencies. So detectives were looking for a needle in a haystack. And the case of who killed Kathleen Doyle goes cold.
Bowman, now back in Michigan, facing the charges for attempted kidnapping of 18-year-old Karen, was sentenced to 5 years in jail. He serves his time and was released in 1986. He moved his wife Brenda and daughter Andrea to Allegan County in Michigan into a little farmhouse along Highway 40.
Now in high school, multiple sources who knew Andrea said the teen was a constant target of bullies.
Why was it that she was bullied so much? And they said, well, because she was a Bowman. So the neighborhood knew who Dennis Bowman was, knew, that he was a creepy sort. And so, you know, consequently, his daughter was treated as, you know, in the same manner. And an interesting thing we've heard from two different boys, or two different men now who were boys at the time, who dated her briefly, and on two different occasions, two different guys that both told us their parents said, don't go around her. You know, you don't associate with her. She's a woman. She's trouble. So, you know, Dennis's reputation rubbed off on her, and the whole neighborhood kind of shunned her and ridiculed her.
Andrea's biological mother, Kathy.
I have to say that I put up a pretty big shield around my feelings, you know. A lot of things I heard just crushed me because, you know, this is a horrifying story.
Andrea fell victim to the all-too-common occurrence when people see something happening, they don't say anything.
If everybody knew she was a Bowman and the word Bowman equaled bad news, when Andrea disappeared, why wasn't he looked at as suspect number one?
That's the big question. Even the current detectives say, you know, that case was botched because it, you know, what seemed obvious to them wasn't apparently obvious to the investigators at the time. I think that the detective that was looking into the case at the time was just a truant officer. He wasn't really a seasoned detective.
Andrea's disappearance was still considered a missing persons case, so Carl Koppelman and Kathy kept digging. They uncovered disturbing accounts of abuse Andrea suffered at the home of her adoptive parents and before she disappeared. When Andrea first tried to get help, she ran away to a classmate's house. That girl spoke to Carl and Kathy.
She fled from the Bowman's house in fear of her safety. And she went to her friend at school and said, please hide me out. He's molesting and hitting me. Well, this little girl didn't know what to do. She was 14 years old too, but she wasn't going to let that happen to her friend. So she hid her out. So from what the girl told me, Alexis didn't miss any school. She went every day. Now, why weren't the Bowmans at the school looking for her? They weren't. That I find very telling. Well, anyway, about 5 days into it, the girl's family realized this child's been here for 5 days.
During this time, the girl tells Kathy Andrea would beg her for ketchup sandwiches.
You know, ketchup sandwiches when she was over at their house. So, you know, and I just want to say right here, if she's begging for ketchup sandwiches, what must she have not been ever exposed to as far as food goes with those two? You know what I mean?
When the classmate's parents found Andrea, it ignited an unforeseen fallout.
The girl's mother eventually discovered that Andrea was staying in the home and said, you know, you need to go to the school and report that you're being abused by your parents. Report to the so that's how this all began, was when she returned to school after staying at this friend's house at the behest of the friend's mother. She told the school authorities that she had been abused. And Child Protective Services got involved. The police got involved. There's, you know, note of it in the police record. The police came by, interviewed Brenda, interviewed Dennis. They both said, well, she's just an incorrigible kid. She doesn't like, you know, she doesn't like the rules around the house. She, behavioral problems. She has behavioral problems.
Well, they were painting her as a runaway who's done it before. However, they weren't uncovering the reasons why. And I think that's what makes it so heartbreaking, is when she truly, as a teenager, tried to seek help, that's when it got even worse for her.
Yeah. I mean, that completely blew everything up, because, of course, Dennis is on parole for this crime in 1980. And then she goes and reports that he's sexually abusing her.
No adult, Child Protective Services, the truant officer, or police believed Andrea's story, and she was forced to return to the Bowman house.
This system failed her from the bottom up.
Right before her classmates last saw her, Andrea's adopted mom, Brenda, reportedly stormed into a school recital and ignited an embarrassing scene.
Brenda came barging into the back room there, made a huge scene about the fact that Andrea was, what she was saying was the problem was that Andrea was using a borrowed flute. They had bought her a flute as a gift, and they wanted her to use the flute that they had bought her. Well, apparently the flute that they had bought her wasn't a very good flute. And so she wanted to use the school's, you know, a school-issued flute. And Brenda, you know, hit the ceiling that she was using this borrowed flute and made a huge scene in the recital room and said, "You're coming home with me," and grabbed her by the arm and pulled her out of the thing.
It's now 1989 and Andrea goes missing. She was 14 years old. The Bowman said she stole some money and took off.
Their presumption all along was that, you know, that she was indeed a runaway. I guess that's the initial attitude that was taken by the law enforcement agency. There was no curiosity whatsoever, about the fact that this guy who's known for offenses against women would would do something, might not be the story that he's telling.
This real-life Sherlock and Watson duo of Carl and Kathy couldn't shake their gut feeling and hired a private investigator. The investigator first talked to Andrea's boyfriend.
The boyfriend had some interesting things to say. One of the things he had told us about Dennis was that he had a fixation with knives. That when he came over to Dennis to visit Andrea, you know, he'd sit down and Dennis would say, "Hey, look at my knife collection." And he said at one point that Dennis had taken one of his knives and shaved the hair off of his forearm to demonstrate how sharp his knife was.
In the same year Andrea goes missing, Bowman was tagged for yet another premeditated attack on a woman. Although married to Brenda, Bowman grew obsessed with a coworker Vicky Brink, and started stalking her and breaking into her home.
Maybe 15, 20 times he broke into my house. Always hacking and scratching himself. And he was just, he was a disgusting man. He really was. Once you got to know him, he was just creepy.
Court transcripts and police reports detail the incident.
And on several numerous occasions, he had broken into her home, and she had a little trailer structure, I think, to the side of her home that he had broken into. And she became aware that, you know, something was going on, that, you know, things didn't look right, things weren't where she had left them. And so she called the police and said, can we set up a silent alarm on the door to see who's breaking into my house? Well, as it turns out, he showed up and broke in again and set off the silent alarm, and the police showed up. And, you know, and he was very calm when the police showed up. He didn't panic, or he didn't, you know, he acted like everything was cool. And he said, I'm staying here for a few days while my house is undergoing electric repairs. And so the police just said, okay, that sounds reasonable. They couldn't get a hold of her, so they left the scene. And then later when they tried to contact her, she says, oh, I never gave him permission into my house. So at that point, they came over to his home, and he was outside. And you know, they said to him, well, you know, this woman says she didn't give you permission into the home. And he says, well, I had diarrhea, and I had to enter her home because I needed to use the restroom. So,
and then they search his home, and they find a shotgun, a bag of tools that one would use to break into someone's home. I mean, an entire ready-to-go burglary.
Yeah, and all her lingerie in the same bag as this sawed-off shotgun. And a Halloween mask of some sort and dark clothing.
Dennis Bowman pled guilty to breaking and entering with intent to commit a felony.
Bowman's wife, Brenda, declined our attempts to interview her. But Carl and Kathy had an encounter with Brenda at a conference for missing children during the time that Andrea was missing.
He said to me, you know, I know who you are. I know, I've seen the things you're writing about my husband. And I said to her, well, you know, what do you expect me to think when I see his criminal record? Her response was, well, I've forgiven him. I haven't forgotten what he did, but I forgive him, and I take my marriage vows seriously. So it sounded like a well-recited line that she had probably told many people on many occasions.
It wasn't quite the calm, emotionless conversation for Kathy when she came face to face with Brenda Bowman.
She said, we got a situation here. And I just came out of my seat. Something just possessed me. And I stood up and I said, Brenda, start telling the truth. You know what happened to her. Tell the truth about your husband. Because I knew everything at that point. And, you know, I just stormed out of the room. You know, did a Jerry Springer, you know. And somebody talked me back into the room.
Years later, in 2019 in Virginia, advancements in DNA testing lead to a break in the Kathleen Doyle case.
We contracted with a private company to essentially have a sample taken not only from the original cervix or vaginal slides, but we had discovered also that there was a very good sample on the bedding that was underneath Kathleen of the same foreign contributor DNA source. And so we submitted an extract from that bedding, and utilizing a private company named Parabon, we ended up getting as a product out of them. What their testing application does is it looks for essentially a different type of DNA. It looks for, I pronounce it, autosomal DNA.
Familial DNA, which gave investigators up to 35 potential matches to family members that may be related to the killer.
Essentially, you have great leads, but without a lucky break or providence shining down on you one way or another, you're going to spend probably several years running down 35 family trees. The ironic lucky break that we received, and we always feel like if you keep working hard, sometimes lucky breaks come your way. The cold case detectives in this case were attending, there was a regional cold case investigators meeting that actually was being held in Norfolk, Virginia, in November of 2019. One of our two detectives, John Smith, had just received the report, and he went to this meeting, and one of the individuals on the board of directors of this group that was holding this conference was from Michigan. And one of the 30-some names on this list was Dennis Bowman, with some sort of connection to Michigan, and believed to have been a potential grandson or great-grandson in this family tree of the common family source. So Detective Smith went to the person and said, "Hey, is there anybody in Michigan I can talk to about this, thinking maybe I can cross one name off my list?" As fate would have it, one of the Michigan state investigators who handles cold case investigations was at this conference, and our detective went over and talked to that investigator, and that investigator looked at the list of 30 to 35 names and said, "Dennis Bowman, I'm familiar with Dennis Bowman."
Within days of connecting labs in Michigan and Virginia, the 30-plus list was narrowed down to one person. Now, with all of the DNA dots connected, it was an exact match to Dennis Bowman. November 2019, Bowman was arrested outside a convenience store for the murder of Kathleen Doyle in 1980. 39 years for this cold case to finally get closure.
Kathleen's mother and brothers do survive, and so they lived to see the person that took, you know, their daughter or sister's life.
The news of Bowman's arrest spread fast, and even though it wasn't for the murder of her daughter, Kathy says it's a start.
I can't tell you, my endorphins just flooded my body. I mean, I was in shock. I probably still am in shock. But they arrested him that day on his way to work.
Phil Evans says they were able to get an inside look into Bowman's mind, his triggers, and his motivations.
He did ask to speak with the investigators after he was back in our jail for a day. And at that point, he did acknowledge going into Kathleen Doyle's residence, but claims he was just going in to look for money. And he said he was drunk at the time, which is interesting because he also drew a floor plan of the residence 40 years removed from the fact. That is absolutely perfect. What's interesting about it is the legacy of each of his events is very clear that he is looking for a person of opportunity or a residence of opportunity, someplace that he can get in and out of. In his writings, he talks about that there are times when the demons in him come back, and that's when he commits these offenses, and he discusses his anger against women. He says it goes back to his childhood, and in much of his writings, he tries to rationalize his behavior to his current wife in writing, talking about comments to the effect of, so it was no wonder that when I got angry, it was at women. He, in his writings to his wife, tries to rationalize that he gets mad, the demons come out, he gets mad at women, but that she is the only woman that he has never let him down.
But his faithful wife finally had enough, and Brenda Bowman makes an unexpected move.
During jailhouse visits and calls to her husband, Brenda says he finally confessed to killing their adopted daughter, Andrea, back in 1989.
Meanwhile, it just so happens, states away, Kathy, the biological mom, had been aggressively urging detectives to dig up the Bowman's backyard in Michigan. You had a premonition that ended up igniting a breakthrough for police. Take me through that.
Well, you know, I spent 10 years discussing this with other people, sitting up sleepless at night sometimes, just trying to formulate this and get this, like, into something my mind could deal with, you know? And in that, I gathered all kinds of information, and some of that information were Google shots of his yard. But one day, I had Google shots in front of me, and each one looked different, you know? And I realized that the first one, the backyard was wide open, and there was something in the backyard that looked like an old slab, okay? And then the next picture I saw was something different in that same space, which I thought was like maybe a garden, you know, right off the backside of his house, oval in shape and probably as long as a small trailer, okay, 25 feet long. And then the third Google shot, and now this is the third Google shot, he knows I'm after him. He knows I know what he's done, and I pretty much know he's killed my daughter, and I'm not letting it go. So the very last Google shot, everything's gone from that spot in the backyard, and it looks like it's been sort of excavated and sort of hidden by the trees and the bushes. And I said to myself, that's where he's got her.
Kathy spent years comparing Google images, monitoring all things regarding Bowman, and pled with detectives to dig it up.
And it wasn't until he was arrested and they had two-thirds of this, well, he was all but admitting that he killed her and buried her in that backyard, that they asked me, Kathy, send over that Google shot you've been telling us about. And the next day or a day later, they were in that backyard digging in that spot. So it wasn't just my epiphany, it was theirs too.
With the help of Brenda Bowman. Once they exhumed the skeletal remains, Kathy got a call from the detective.
I know that he said, you know, you knew the whole time. They identified her bones as her on the 11th of March, which was exactly 31 years after Dennis Bowman killed her and buried her in his backyard.
And now, breaking news. Brenda Bowman appeared in court at the preliminary hearing on February 22nd of 2001 to testify that her husband confessed to killing Andrea.
He allegedly got into an argument with a teen at the family home. Dennis reportedly lost his temper, either punched or slapped her, sending her body to fall down a staircase, then dismembered and buried her body.
As the news came out on Bowman's arrest in two states, word started to spread throughout the smaller communities, and more victims came forward. A woman saying she was kidnapped at 6 years old, also in 1989, the same year he was charged with stalking and breaking and entering the home of a coworker.
She told us a story about how she was on the street corner. It was a 6-year-old girl had just gotten out of school. And a man pulled up in a red Ford truck, said, do you want to see my puppies? And she walked up to his truck and he grabbed her and pulled her into the truck and drove her away from the scene. Took her nearly 20 miles. I think it was like 19 miles from the location she was taken to this county campground in Allegan County. Took all her clothes off, tied her up, and was about to sexually assault her. And then some dogs showed up and started barking at him. And he panicked and left her at the scene and hopped into his truck and left. Well, as it turns out, you know, the woman is telling us this story. And I thought to myself, well, the location you just described where you were taken from is right next to where Dennis Bowman works. The location you were taken to is right down the street from where Dennis Bowman lives.
Carl, who's been working as an amateur sleuth for 11 years now, has helped solve cases. Part of the DNA Doe project consisted of solving 25 cases to date before authorities started using forensic genealogy.
Well, thank you so much for all you do for the known victims and the nameless victims.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
As for Kathy, you said if I didn't give her up for adoption, she would not have died. And I hope you don't truly feel that way. But if you do at this point, years later, what would bring you peace and just allow your heart to release everything that you could not control?
Good question. I don't know. I haven't gotten there yet. See, when all this happened, I had a very rough childhood, and I thought I addressed everything. I mean, I was in good shape when this happened. When I, mentally, physically, I was about as close to okay as I was ever going to get. And this just gutted that for me. But it's amazing, when you heal, there's always like a scar that protects it from ever getting any deeper.
Kathy, do you have a message for Dennis Bowman?
I'm going to come visit him. I'm going to go visit him. Get ready. I'm going to come visit you.
Dennis Bowman has been transferred from Norfolk, Virginia, to face the murder trial of his adopted daughter, Andrea Bowman, in Allegan County, Michigan.
I would say that without a doubt, he has committed other crimes. There are other crimes.
He's a narcissistic sociopath who just cannot be redeemed.
This has been Killer Jeans.
And we always want to hear from you. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Killer Jeans, the podcast.